The women of Chicago's silent majority speak up on the war, youth, crime, and other major issues, starting Sunday in Chicago Today. This is WGN Television, Channel 9, Chicago's own television station. Good evening. We have two, I think, very interesting panels. The first consists of five people from, well, four of them are from old-time radio and one is from modern radio, but he specializes in old-time radio. And the second panel is a panel of five hairstylists in town to attend the national convention, the 50th National Convention of the Hairstylists Association. So stick around and we'll both have fun.
Robert Cromie, host of The Cromie Circle.
Well, here we are at the little theater off Times Square. Have your tickets ready, please. Have your tickets ready, please.
Good evening, Mr. First Nighter. The usher will show you to your box.
Thank you. We'll go right in.
Well, thanks for coming over to tell me, Gioli. It was very thoughtful of you.
Thoughtful, my clavicle. He stole my idea and took the last punch himself.
Anybody steal ideas from you, McGee, it's only petty larceny. And I apologize to the Larsons for saying so.
Well, I still think it was a dirty trick.
I don't have to come over and tell you, McGee, you know. I'm making no money on my lunch hour. I'm just donating my time.
Yes, he is, McGee, and you should
I go out the side door, Mrs. I saved...
Oh, no, not that door.
No, no, that's the house. I don't go...
It's Adventure Time with Awesome Annie.
Was either three or four or five old radio programs. I spotted Thurber McGee the Molly, as I'm sure you did, and of course Little Orphan Annie. And we'll introduce our panelists, and then we'll let them tell us what the others were. We have Paul Barnes, who still, of course, is on radio. He's an actor. He does a lot of voiceovers, does a lot of commercials. And you were on Captain Midnight, I think, for quite a long time, weren't you?
That's right. Mostly as a bunch of villains, but finally as the last Captain Midnight.
Good. John Gannon, who is now an assistant state's attorney, but used to be Billy on Jack Armstrong, and you were a former attorney for AFTRA, I believe.
No, I was a vice president of the national body and the local body, but they had very competent legal counsel. I was an actor in the union.
You must be competent legal counsel now, but then you weren't, eh? Forget that.
I think that's right.
Sarah Jane Wells, who is now at the Chicago Historical Society as a workman, not as a worker, I mean, not as an exhibit or anything. She's not that old with her old-time radio. And Sarah Jane played Betty with the Jack Armstrong Show. And, of course, what else? You did Woman in White and numerous others.
Yes, I was in almost all of the Erna Phillips shows that came out of Chicago and eventually out of Hollywood.
Good. And we have Chuck Shaden. Chuck is the gentleman I mentioned who is the modern, of course the others are both modern, but you don't do any old-time stuff except you show old-time shows.
I play old-time
shows. What I mean is you don't go back to the old days of radio, but you are very interested in them.
Right.
Chuck, you're on WNMP, Saturdays from 1 to 4.
That's correct.
Right. And that is 1590, I think.
All the way on the right side of the dock.
And you do show, you do tapes from the old shows, don't you?
Right, we play excerpts of the good old golden days of radio. We play Lum and Abner, a whole Fibber McGee and Molly program. Good. A slice out of Mr. Keene, Tracer of Lost Persons.
And, of course, you also are executive editor of the Press Reporter Journal group of papers.
Right.
Of neighborhood papers or suburban papers.
On the northwest side of Chicago. Right.
And finally, Norman Gottschalk, another very well-known name in radio. And you did an awful lot of the old soap operas, and you still, of course, are doing radio jobs, but you were in a great many of the old soap operas. Was it legal to have a soap opera without you in it in those days?
I objected an awful lot. It was legal.
When did you start, Norman?
I tell you, it was real hard to get started in Chicago. I have a something at home that I did for Mary Affleck in 1932, but really never got going in Chicago because their excuse was we have to have people with radio experience. I'd had theater experience, but not radio. So while working at the World's Fair, 1933 and 1934, in the streets of Paris, I got home one morning about 4 o'clock and found a note on the table to contact two men from WLW in Cincinnati, Don Becker and Harry Holcomb, and see if I couldn't get an audition with them. I got an audition with them, and they offered me a job and a magnificent salary, $25 a week.
Well, they were paying well in those days, weren't they?
Yeah, weren't they, though? I should say.
Were you an announcer then, or what?
No, I was an actor.
Hmm.
And I said if they would up it to 35, why, I could be in Cincinnati faster than they could be there. And they said, okay, 35. And I went to WLW.
Well, Norm, Powell Crosley was running the station then.
Yes, he was.
And you probably worked with Charlie Calvert down there.
Oh, I did, yeah.
But what they had down there, Bob, they stole some of our fine actors. And they had a big group of actors, and they worked them. If he worked for $35 a week for Crosley, I'll wager that he did over 20 15-minute shows a week. I've never discussed this with you.
We did, yeah.
But they had a company of actors, and they overworked them. And out of that company came, Charlie Calvert was here and went down there and returned. But many of our actors were with you down there.
Astra may have come out of that company, too, if they worked them that hard.
Well,
really, probably that was the inspiration.
If you'll recall, Crosley had 500,000 watts for a short period of time. On an experimental basis, and he thought he could blanket the country, and so he had a holding company of actors down there, and they cut him back to, I think, 100,000, which was still tremendous.
Yeah, that's right. It was half a million watts.
That's right, but it was only
500,000 watts, and the Federal Communications Commission, I don't know much about that, but they said that he was covering the United States and Mexico and, you know. Mm.
It was an experimental period, and I don't recall when it quit, but I do know that when you were down there, one of the reasons for the company of actors was that they had this tremendous power.
Yeah.
When was the first soap opera? Sarah Jane, do you know when soap operas started?
Well, my dear friend Virginia Payne tells me that she started as Ma Perkins in Cincinnati.
Uh-huh.
In 1931, and eventually, of course, Perkins moved to Chicago. And
but did they have them before that, before 31?
I don't think so. Unless you
call Clara Lou and Em.
Well, Amos and Andy, that kind of thing. But the soaper really began when Procter and Gamble and that soap came because it was advertised by soap companies.
Well, Bob Andrews is
that, but that was about 33.
How long did you break in, Sergeant?
I started in 1933.
As
on Jack Armstrong.
Jack Armstrong?
Yes.
And how long did
as
that run?
As an infant.
In arms.
Well, she's not kidding. I remember having to take her across the street.
She was a very literate infant, but anyway.
Yeah, she must have played small parts because she's so tiny.
True.
Would you like another telephone book for your feet?
No, this one is enough. Thank you.
How long were you with the Jack Armstrong show?
Until 1947, when I went to California with another show that I had, which was A Woman in White.
And when did you go to the Historical Society?
In January 1953.
It's a nice place to work, isn't it?
It's wonderful, and I've had a very fulfilling and interesting career there.
A great place to visit. Paul, how long have you been?
I started in March 4th, 1934, which makes it 36 years plus. And my first show was a program called True Detective Mysteries. I was a high school kid wearing knickers, which is what high school boys wore in those days, buckled below the knee. And
long
I was wondering,
stockings.
Long stockings. And I was wandering around downtown on a holiday from school. For some reason, the school was closed that day.
This is in Chicago?
In Chicago, yeah. Yeah, I'm a Chicago native, born and bred, and grew up here and stayed here, pretty much. And I passed the Palmer House and remembered reading that a radio station had just moved in there, and it's WAAF. And I'd never seen one. So I decided to go in and take a look. And I took the elevator up to the top and then climbed some more stairs into the penthouse. A lot of people were sitting around, so I sat down too. The fellow came out and said, "Okay, everybody, come with me." And I thought it was the tour. And so I went on the tour, only in the studio. Scripts were passed out, and I had done enough plays to recognize a script when I saw one and kept my mouth shut until he said, "Would you read for me, please?" And at 15, I won the role of a 60-year-old doctor in the show. That was my first my first professional engagement. I've been in it ever since.
That's a lovely story.
It's true.
Did you stay with the station then?
I did two programs a week on that station and then branched out to others. In my last year of college, I dropped out of radio to make sure I got out of college. And then when I came back, everybody was different except the actors. Most of the actors were still here, but all the producers had changed in 1 year. And I had to take auditions all over again to get back into the business. It took me 6 or 8 months to get back.
Producers are more expendable than the actors, I guess.
Must be. Or else they grow faster. I don't know. Maybe they grew to greater heights. That's all.
John, how did you get out, for heaven's sake, from radio business into the law school?
Well, I went to school all the time I was on the program.
Oh, I see.
And I had 2 years of high school and a modicum of law school.
How do you get to be an assistant state's attorney with a modicum of law school?
Well, there's a very fine man in this community named Daniel Patrick Ward, and he saw something that nobody else did, and he hired me, and nobody has caught up with me yet.
Ah, great. Do you still remember any of the lines from the time when you were Billy?
I only had one line.
What'd you say?
Gee, Jack, I never thought of that.
What plumps when you cook it?
Popcorn? Cake?
A hot dog.
A hot dog?
Sure. A high-grades ballpark Frank plumps when you cook it. Watch them. They're all meat. The tenderest, leanest, juiciest, meatiest meat ever put into a hot dog. High-grades ballpark Franks. They plump when you cook them.
If shag is your bag, shag carpet that is, then you must get in on Bushell's sensational shag spectacular. Call Hudson 3-2700 and have Bushell bring to your home thick, luxurious 100% polyester shag carpeting, unrivaled for bringing in rich elegance to any room. Deep pile shag carpeting that alone sells for $10 and $11 a square yard. Yet for a limited time only, Bushell installs it in your home wall to wall, complete with rubber padding for just $6.66 a yard. Choose from greens, golds, blues, all the newest colors, and pay only $6.66 a yard. Install the complete price, including genuine rubber crest padding. Use your bank card or Bushell's budget plan. Call Bushell at Hudson 3-2700 to see spectacular carpet values in your home. $9.95 to $11.95 qualities, your choice at $6.66 a yard. Call Hudson 3-2700 Suburbs Call Collect. Palatine Savings and Loan now offers free gifts to new savers. Deposit $100 to $5,000. Call 359-4900 or visit Palatine Savings and Loan. Hurry, offer limited. Deposit your money in passbook or certificate accounts or save with IOME coupons. At Palatine Savings and Loan, their personnel will help you with every aspect of home financing. Come to Palatine Savings and Loan, an interested investor in a growing community. It's high time.
No, you said something
Golly gee whiz or something.
No,
like
that. Well, I may.
Yeah,
but,
you're going to hear
that. Was
my line. And if radio ever comes back, I'm ready.
That's if you're ready, Sarah.
Oh, I'm ready.
How long did you do that?
Well, I started after Sarah Jane. I started in September of 1933. And I replaced a fine actor, Junior McLean, if you recall. Murray McLean was his square name, but his mother was a director, and they started the Air Adventures of Jimmy Allen, so he'd rather be the lead on Jimmy Allen, which lasted a year and a half, than the second boy on Jack Armstrong. We remember recording at World up on the top of the Daily News building?
Indeed, I do.
We'd do a scene out in the desert someplace, and a boat would whistle for the bridge to come up. We were on the 25th floor, take the elevator to the 24th, as you said about the Palmer House,
sure,
and walk up a flight. And no matter what happened, we had those steamboat whistles. And if you were in the jungle in Africa or out at sea someplace, well, I guess
what
it's
did you say? Quite a rainy season we're having? Or
we just overlooked it. Those records, I don't know, Sari, if you remember. Fred Brown was our recordist there. Those were Hill and Dale records. The sound wasn't in the walls of the groove. It was in the bottom of the groove. It was a Western Electric sound system.
Yeah.
But after a year of that, we went to RCA and started to record on those 16-inch discs. They had a mail to New Jersey, and we had to make the show 3 weeks ahead of time. And they'd take two waxes and put one in one trunk and one in the other. Hopefully, one trunk would get to Camden, New Jersey. And the records would be mailed out to the subscribing stations from there.
Before we went on the air, I mentioned a friend of mine, Norm Berry, who also was an old-time radio man.
Oh,
and you said you remember how he got fired from where?
Oh. Well, Jimmy Amici and I, when we weren't deviling Sarah Jane, we were trying to push the announcers around. Truman Bradley was there. Now, Truman Bradley was probably the first man I know that wore sharply tailored handmade suits. And he was very proud, and he strutted, and he had clips on his heels. And he's walking up the corridor one day, and Les Atlas comes by, and Atlas didn't like the way he looked. So he grabbed the program manager, and he says, "You know that guy that dresses very well, and one of our announcers?" And he says, "Yes." He says, "Fire him." So the guy goes down. The first person he sees is Norm Berry. And he says, "Norm, Uncle Les, you're gone." So he goes up the river, and he's hired at WMAQ the same day. And 2 days later, Les Atlas held a conference of war because who was Fibber's announcer?
Harlow
Wilcox had just left the staff to join Fibber, McGee, and Molly, and now Norm Berry is up there. And he announces that Herbivore is raiding our talent. And they never did have nerve enough to tell him that he meant to fire Truman Bradley, but they fired Norman Berry.
And Jules and Norm are together, WEMF, right?
Jules,
now.
Jules, EFF, yes.
But Norman came to CBS from WIBO, which was the predecessor of WIND. Mm-hmm. WIBO used to broadcast up at Broadway and Devon.
John, we have a tape, I think, of maybe you saying your line on Jack Armstrong.
You're lying.
I want to tell you something. I'll enjoy it.
So will I. But let's listen to it anyway.
That's me.
We've got to keep our eyes peeled, Billy. If Lazaro and his men discover that we're on the way up to the cave, we won't have a chance.
Don't I know it, Jack. Why, if Lazaro could get rid of the Secret Service men and Whisper and us all at the same time, he'd have clear sailing.
That's right. He joined the High Yami in the ruined Inca city. And as soon as the High Yami started the Indian revolts, Lazaro would flash the word to all his agents.
Oh, but I don't see how Lazaro could possibly know that we're on the way up to the cave, Jack. Lazaro thinks we're still fooled by those fake Secret Service men.
Yeah, but just the same, Lazaro knows we won't give up until we find Whisper. He's bound to have a guard placed around the cave.
Yeah, and he'll let us walk in and then capture us.
Look, Uncle Jim and Senor Quesada have stopped where the trail turned. They must have seen something.
Uncle Jiminy, I hope they haven't run into any of Lazaro's men.
Uncle Jim is looking through his binoculars, Jack. Perhaps he's looking at the cave of the glacier. Why, maybe he can even see Whisper.
I imagine Whisper and the other prisoners are way back in the cave, Betty. Can you see the cave of the glacier, Uncle Jim?
All I see is the glacier, Jack. Be careful there, Betty. Don't get too close to the edge of the cliff. You'd drop 1,000 feet if you slipped. Keep close against the mountainside.
Oh, all right, Uncle Jim.
Well, Betty, your voice was on there, wasn't it?
Yes.
Were you on that particular segment?
Yes, and
he was the one
now
was
we
saying...
know what happened to radio. Yeah.
You two haven't changed a bit.
Oh, thank you.
That's great.
Now, I remember Herb was Whisper, mm-hmm. the man of a thousand voices. Mm-hmm. Herb, what's his name?
Can't remember now.
Herb.
Nobody knows.
Herb Butterfield.
Butterfield, right.
I don't know who played Lazaro. You probably did.
You were probably in that, Norm.
I was waiting for you. I played Lazaro.
Did you?
I played Lazaro. And Franklin McCormick was announcing Jack Armstrong at that time. And, you know, he has never to this day called me anything but, hello, Gypsy, when he sees me, because this Lazaro was a Gypsy-type villain, you know.
Well, I'd like to tell Bob, you know, when we started, there were two CBS shows that were heard on WGN. Helen Trent and Just Plain Bill. They originated in our studio, Studio 2. But that staff, with Norman Berry, who went to NBC, and Harlow Wilcox, who went to NBC, and Franklin McCormick, Holland Engel was a mainstay of the CBS staff, and now Holland, who is one of the most charming men we'll know, is a mainstay of WGN. Johnny Harrington was still announcing sports down at KMOX St. Louis, so he hadn't hit yet. But that staff was a very fine staff. They were all fine people.
A fantastic staff.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Chuck, we haven't brought you into the conversation much. Where did you get the idea of doing Those Were the Days, your radio show?
Well, I've always been greatly interested in the old shows since I heard them. When these folks were doing the voices of Billy and Betty.
Why don't you open a home and populate it with all radio actors and support it?
Not ready for a home.
We might be able to do that. No, I was born in 34, and I never got out of about 43. You see, I've been living from 35 to 45 all my life, I think. But I've always wanted to get these programs and to listen to them again, because I remember them so much, so well. And anytime there would be a record with an excerpt in it or something like that from an old show, I grabbed it up. And all of a sudden, I realized people traded tapes. People who enjoyed the programs when they were first presented, they made a copy of it. Some fellas sitting in his living room with one of those old acetate record cutting machines. He'd sit there and he'd get excerpts of Red Skelton, you know, from 1943. He wouldn't take the whole show. He'd take Junior to Mean Widow Kid or Clem Cadiddlehopper. Another guy is hung up on Tarzan of the Apes. And, my personal collection has 77 consecutive episodes of Tarzan of the Apes from 1934 with Edgar Rice Burroughs' daughter Jane as Jane and her husband, who was a movie Tarzan.
Folk. Yeah. He's not the he's our modern version. It was those folk that really saved some wonderful things. I know a very accomplished artist from Local 10, Virginia Murphy. We were talking about how grateful we were that the Benny Goodman band was recorded off the line by somebody in Pittsburgh. And you can go down to your local Dublin's or whatever the record store name is now and buy off-the-line recordings of Benny Goodman's band that some home recordist that you've just described.
Correct.
And Virginia is hung up on Wayne Miller, and of course I'm a Benny Goodman fan.
Do you all have collections of tapes? Do you have old tapes?
A few. Well, we didn't have tape in those days. We had acetate and wax and aluminum and Lord knows what all. But I have a few that still play, but I'm afraid to play them. I should have them transferred.
Sure, Chuck. Yeah, if anybody watching, Chuck, has any old tapes, you wish they'd get in touch with you, I presume.
Sure. And if anybody's interested in collecting.
Where do they get in touch with you? We might as well get this on the record.
Well, they can check with me at WNMP, GR5-1590.
Good. How many collectors are there?
I would say there are no more than 1,000 collectors in the country.
But there's no limit to the number of tapes you can do. I mean, if there are 50,000, you can just proliferate the tapes.
Well, you see, if you have a tape
and I have a tape,
we'll switch, we'll swap.
Yeah.
And I'll make a copy of the program for you, and you make a copy for me. And we each build our collections then.
You know, unless the vault has been cleaned out, Universal Recording here in town had a year's worth of calling all detectives. on tape.
Great. Let's listen to a tape of Paul. He's sitting there looking wistful while we were listening to a tape of
well, you were talking
John
about
and Sarah Jane.
You were talking about Captain Midnight. And Paul says he was the last Captain Midnight,
which
makes him about Captain 1230, I think. But, at any rate, this is a tape of Paul Barnes as the last Captain Midnight.
This is one of your tapes we're listening to.
One of my tapes, right.
There you are. Make a deal after the show, man.
You tough guy. You ain't swinging no more at nobody, see?
Hold on, Nicky. They're armed.
We sure are. That's yours in your head, big boy. Now, tell the kid to hand over the plane.
It looks as though you'll have to give them the plane, Chuck. For the time being.
Listen to the big talk.
But, Captain.
Better do as the captain says, Chuck. They got us covered.
Hey, wait a minute. Hey, what's this stuff? Captain. Who are you?
I'm Captain Midnight.
Captain Midnight, eh? You're the secret squadron?
That's right.
Well, ain't it just too bad we got no secrets to tell you?
Shut up, Joe. I don't like this.
What do you mean you don't like it? Just what I said.
Oh, forget it. Let's grab the plane and beat it. Who cares who he is?
We're all members of the secret squadron.
For $500, you can get a copy of that tape.
I didn't know that existed.
Isn't that funny?
I'm delighted and thrilled, and Chuck says I can have a copy one way or another.
How many do you have?
We'll trade something.
495.
Of the Midnights, how many do you have?
There are about four or five Captain Midnights that I have in my collection, but only one with the new and improved Paul Barnes.
That was the early Paul Barnes. This is the new improved.
Oh, that was the man of a thousand voices.
That's right, back then.
Chuck, may I ask him a question? There are some companies now who are selling tapes. You're not in that end.
I don't sell them. Those are basically people who wish to help. I don't know if they're trying to make a profit out of it.
Well, of course.
But you see, you want as a person who doesn't have any tapes want to start a collection. So you may buy some tapes from someone who will only give up his tapes if you buy them from him. Then you get into the mainstream of trading and the way you go, you see. So you make a small investment. My approach to the thing is that I don't want to corner the market on old radio tapes. I want everybody to enjoy them, and that's why I got this radio
But if you
thing.
Bought the two rarest tapes, then you would have excellent trading material with everybody, wouldn't you?
Well, I explained about the Tarzan.
Yeah.
That package of Tarzan has gotten me so many things. I've got the Cinnamon Bear. Anybody remember the Cinnamon Bear?
Yes.
Kids program that ran for 26 episodes prior to Christmas every year, and it's about the crazy quilt dragon who stole the star off the Christmas tree. And the two kids are going through everything to get the star back with Patio Cinnamon, the Cinnamon Bear, in time for Christmas. And, of course, at the end of 26 exciting adventures, we have the star back on
Sounds
the
like
trees.
An audio version of Sesame Street.
Not quite, but it's close.
I've got a good one to trade you, Chuck.
Okay.
A copy, it's on acetate, I've got to have it put on tape, of the Northerners program on NBC, with the chorus and full orchestra. And at the end of the program, the announcer says, "Thank you, Mr. Paul Barnes. Next week, our guest star, Ronald Reagan."
Whatever became of him? Yeah.
Yes.
Is that a good trade?
Sure, I'll swap it.
Well, you know what I'd like to know? When we first started recording, Betty and Bob on the 11th floor, RCA, in the Merchandise Mart, like John explained before, we used to make them on wax discs, about 16 inches and about that thick. And are there any tapes of shows like that were recorded on those wax discs that John says they put in two trunks, in this and one in that.
So if you remember, they dropped two needles.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, that's where the tapes come from.
Yeah, two masters.
Wax discs.
Yes.
Well, now, who had availability? I mean, where?
Well, this is what's happened. This is why radio lives only in the hands of the collectors today, really. Old radio does. Because so many studios, when they transferred from the old studio to the new studio, you know, in the last 30 years, they said, "What do we want all this junk for?"
That's right.
Throw it out, you know, and we cringe when we think of it.
I can make you cringe worse than that.
Go ahead.
I moved once and threw out all the Jack Armstrong scripts.
Whoops.
All of them.
Leave the program at once.
Drum him out of
scripts are all right, but I have some scripts here.
I'd like to talk about
hey, here's a trade. Wait a minute. We've got a trade offer here, John.
Go ahead.
What's the trade offer?
I'll trade you anything in my collection for any of your scripts.
Well, I have Chicago Theater of the Air scripts.
UGM?
I was on Chicago Theater of the Air. It was the happiest 15 years of my life in radio. And I have a lot of those. And I have Molly of the Movie scripts. I have Backstage Wife scripts.
Mary Noble,
yes. Backstage sure. Wife.
Ken Griffin.
Excuse me, John. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Played the Japanese houseboy, Sago. And he was just the sweetest guy in the world. And if Sago hadn't been in the story, why, Mary Noble wouldn't have had a shoulder to cry on.
You played this?
I played Sago.
How was your accent? How do you accent?
It was marvelous. I would rather not do any accent right now. But then, you know, there came a time we had some trouble with another country in Manchuria, and there was
And the Japs potato chips had to change their name overnight to Jay's Potato Chips and spend a fortune.
Is that right?
Well, sure, because the Jap family with two peas had been making a fine potato chip for years, and on December the 8th, they changed their name to Jay's. We were on WGN at the time, and our program was changed from a 15-minute program to a 10-minute program because everybody knew the war was going to be over.
You were with Pierre Andre, weren't you? And I think we have a picture of you and Pierre doing something.
Well, Pierre and I were adding to the national revenue by being in a drinking establishment.
It's on the monitor now. What are you doing?
We're over on the Ye Olde Cellar, I believe, on Michigan Avenue. And Pierre has just come back from Hollywood. And I was doing something I used to do very well. I was having
talking
a scotch
to Pierre,
and soda.
I know. How long ago was that?
I would say that's 1946.
Well, it's a very attractive picture.
And you look pretty good, too.
What I wanted to say about the outbreak of World War II, there was a bartender up on Wilson Avenue that said he wasn't going to shave until it was over. But they cut our program from 14:30 to 10 minutes, and Vinnie Pelletier came over to do the news. And we had the news every night, 5 minutes every night. And after a while, Sam Gale up at General Mills decided that maybe we ought to go back to 14 minutes and 30 seconds and let them get the news on the hour instead of the Alfire program. But I wanted to say, Norm, we were a very successful cliffhanging operation. And we sold the product, and the PTAs hated us. And Ed Morse was the director at the time. And he came in one day so sick. Ed Morse used to rewrite the Jack Armstrong script. He was our director, possibly the greatest director, at least the greatest one I ever worked for.
Marvelous.
And he'd rewrite the whole script. He was a complete man. He had taken the Trial of Mary Dugan to London. He had taken the Shanghai Gesture to Shanghai. He was stage director for Guthrie McClintock and Miss Cornell.
To mention the Dead End Kids.
The Dead End Kids when Dead End came here. But he said, they have just rejected my rewrites, and we wanted to know why. They hired a fellow from Northwestern University who was a child psychologist to read our scripts and to put them into shape. So I'm coming down on the Loyola Express one morning. We had a recording session at RCA, 9 o'clock every morning, room 1143, as you said, Norm. Along about Wilson Avenue, I just had a breakout in laughter. It was in the wintertime, because there was a six-head in the Tribune that said, Joe Moderatz, or whatever this clown's name was, a child psychologist on the faculty of Northwestern University, who, when his car was hit by a snowball, stopped the car, got out, and grabbed a 13-year-old boy and punched him on the mouth. So I went down into room 1143, and I said, Blackett Sample is not going to keep this lad under. And we got the child psychologist influence out of our program. But it was so, the casting.
And that was your kid that threw the snowball?
No, some lad up in Evanston, but it was just wonderful, because we didn't really brook any interference from those intellectual types. But the thing that really made us sick, Blackett Sample was a terrible operation, really. They were so big. Although they sold more time in Chicago than time was sold on both coasts for commercial radio. They had a Betty and Bob audition, and Ed Eckhart, the chief recordist.
Yes, I remember him well.
I've never seen him closer to tears. He said, do you know what Blackett Sample did on that, we're going to cast a little girl, you know, an ingenue. They brought the wives of a couple of big shots from Blackett Sample over to stand in the behind the glass and to listen to see whether this girl who was auditioning sounded, you know, which that isn't bad enough, but they made their final choice by looking through the window and picking this one instead of that one visually for radio. They had ever, you two probably both auditioned for
Color
the
radio.
Cool. Remember when the NBC held a big thing?
John,
penguins don't make any noise, and they auditioned a guy to say cool, and he had to sound like a penguin, which didn't make any noise. I blew that audition off.
I know penguins that used to make noise, but they never smoked. You don't even sound like an assistant state's attorney. You sound like some guy off old-time radio.
Well, doesn't he?
John, I wanted to ask you, what's the funniest thing ever happened to you during one of the shows?
Oh.
A blooper or anything?
Well, it didn't happen to me. It happened about me,
that's
really. It was a show I had on ABC, a radio show, which I was announcing. And there was a fellow named Chester Morrison, a former war correspondent, who was doing a show for Coronet magazine called Coronet Front Page, I believe it was. And Chester was talking about atom bombs as contrasted with the brand new DDT bug bomb. And his whole program was about, it was a 5-minute show. At the end of it, he said, so it remains to be seen which is more important to man's future, the atom bomb or the bug bomb. And now a word from Paul Baum.
Even if you're all thumbs, you can do fantastic card tricks with Magic Cards, the foolproof deck that works amazing card tricks all by itself. Ask a friend to pick a card, place it back in the deck, tap the deck, and it's back on top again. Make 3 piles. Whatever pile he points to, the card is there, but the fun's just begun. Now, take the top card, tap it, and it changes back to his card. Place it on the bottom of the deck, and they all change into his card. Cut the deck, and they're all different again. Magic Cards, the foolproof deck that works card tricks by itself, is available at Treasure Chest, 19 West Randolph Street, across from the Oriental Theater. Or for immediate delivery, send $2 check or money order to Magic Cards, Fox Lake, Illinois. A fantastic gift for anyone from 6 to 60. Magic Cards. A good deal.
Ah, to sleep like a log. Better perhaps to sleep like a person. Come to Henry M. Goodman and get yourself a nice new bedroom set and a nice new mattress, comfortably priced to save you money. A log never had it so good.
Imperiale's Restaurant in Palatine has delighted customers for 16 years with the finest Italian cuisine. A congenial atmosphere that creates conversation. Imperiale's caters to the businessman and family with cooked-to-order meals at popular prices. For a downtown meal with personal service, dine at Imperiale's, Northwest Highway in Palatine. Why not put a little lasagna into your life? Visit Pat Puccia's Imperiale's.
That's funny. How about you, John? Did you have a funny one?
Well,
a funny memory?
I thought I was fired, and I really didn't have anything to do with the action, but in September or November, when I was still hoping that if they didn't pick up my option, W. Alexander would hire me again as an office boy for $15 a week, I was doing a show with a shot, and you were there, Sari, with Jack Doty, who was playing Captain Hughes, and Frank Ding. Now, Paul and Norman and Sarah Jane, incidentally, I still remember seeing you in Let Us Be Gay at the Evanston Community Theater.
Oh, my.
That's a long time. They all had a professional background, and I didn't. I was an office boy. And after
but an appealing one.
After 10 years in the industry, I was still that office boy. But this particular show, I had left a regular, good-paying job, you know, and I had memorized all the names of the agents at W. Alexander & Company, so I could really deliver that mail. Jack Armstrong is flying in an airplane, and Captain Hughes and Billy and Frank are down on the ground. I've forgotten what mechanic part Frank was playing. And Frank was supposed to say, Jack is going to crack up. So he said something else, and then he repeated it, and then he repeated it, and the third time it was very strangulated. He never did say Jack is going to crack up. And I looked at David Owen, our peachy supervisor, and I thought, well, shortest career in the history of broadcasting. We're all fired.
But you survived.
Well, the funny part about it is you could say anything on radio, and if you didn't repeat it, if you just kept on going, nothing had happened. You mentioned about Norman Berry. I don't know whether it's Norman or Charlie Lyon in 40 or 41 when His Holiness was ill. He said, and now for the latest news from Rome about Pope Pius.
Sarah Jane, have you got a funny memory?
Oh, I have a funny memory. But so many funny things happened on the Armstrong show that I could write a book. Perhaps one of the funniest is the time that we were in a storm at sea, and the sea was very heavy, the noise was terrific, water was pouring over the boat, and we were shouting at each other, which we did all the time. That was one of the techniques. And that was the day that Franklin McCormick thought it would be very funny to pour a box of bubble bath into the water tub that the sound man is
and he did
swishing.
It between shows.
And, of course, as it bubbled more and more, it got quieter and quieter. And Charlie Flynn and Johnny and I are all shouting, watch it, get over the rapids, hurry, hurry. And I never saw as sick a man in my life as the producer, the director, sitting in the control room, and I don't believe he ever forgave Franklin McCormick.
It was a clean shot.
It was a clean
shot. Still pushing suds, isn't he?
Well, he's still pushing suds, but what he did...
Different guy.
This was frantic.
You couldn't play a recording on the network, and you couldn't buy the Eastern time zone with a recording network. So we had a show at 4:30 for the Eastern time zone, and a show at 5:30 for the Middle West, and then some off-the-line recordings off that. But what Frank did... We used to have that 45 minutes off and go down to the drugstore for coffee. He did it between shows so that the show was rehearsed and we satisfied the sponsor we knew had a pipeline for the first show. So if you heard the first show, the sponsor hears the first show and we do the repeat at 5:30. And that's the show that he lost up,
the
repeat.
The bubbles, sir.
And the more they turn the paddle wheel, of course, the more bubbles you got and the less water.
Norman, do you remember?
I don't have any recollection of anything that I can tell on the air now. I recall many, many things, but, you know, John had to leave out a word, and I would have to leave out a lot of words. Well, but I do remember the most wonderful compliment I ever received, and I think it's worth telling. Mike Wallace, the announcer on... Sky King left the show and went into the service, you know. And he wrote back to the cast on the show that when he went to the South Seas, all the natives came out in their canoes to either barter or exchange or say hello or get some food or whatnot, you know. And he was tremendously surprised because they all sounded like Norm Gottschalk.
who played so many South Sea Islanders.
On that note, we'll have to wrap it up for now, but I've enjoyed it. And let me reintroduce our guests and thank them. We've been talking with, of course, four people from old-time radio and one who was an old-time radio buff. Paul Barnes, who still acts on radio, is a voiceover, does commercials, and was Captain Midnight for a full year. Or as Chuck said, maybe Captain 1230, because he was the last Captain Midnight. John Gannon, now an assistant state's attorney, who played Billy on Jack Armstrong, and was also... Are you still an actor, by the way?
I have an honorable withdrawal card. I think there's a little conflict of interest. But, right.
Anyway, you're one of the early after people.
I'm a charter member as a Sari.
Sarah Jane Wells, who is now at the Chicago Historical Society, and she was Betty with Jack Armstrong and also played in Woman in White and numerous other shows. Chuck Shaden, who has a show called Those Were the Days on WNMP from Saturdays from 1 to 4 p.m. on 1590, way over to the right on your radio dial. Mm-hmm. And Chuck, of course, collects old tapes. He is also executive editor of Press-Reporter-Journal newspapers. And finally, Norman Gottschalk, who acted, we figure, in every old soap opera that was ever done for how many years?
Well, since 1934.
And thank you all very much, and thank you, and don't go away because we'll be back.